Hello and welcome to the Maverick Radio Hour. I'm your host, GT Maverick, and I have for y'all another extemporaneous verbal essay. Today is October 20th, 2021, and we are still rolling through this crazy year and the madness imposed upon us for some while. Apparently it's still going through. Also, it's great to see a lot of pushback on the virus panic front and the abuses of authority, which have been happening still. Yet, it looks like the tipping point is occurring. It really is. There is one after the other after the other. People standing up, millions across our country and across the world, who are standing up against these overbearing power grabs that are clearly unconstitutional and anti-human spirit, and ultimately aim to turn us into worse slaves than there ever was in history. So that's good. There's a lot that's positive that's happening on that front. People are waking up about this, and they're stepping it up in their own lives. And they're really starting to have some courage. When one person steps up, it takes a little while sometimes, but when others see it, it is contagious. It really is. I would encourage all of y'all to respect yourselves and have the value that you inherently have, and to reject the lies of the liars out there who just keep peddling their propaganda. I just so happened to, before I came out today, grab a New York Times. Grab the paper from today, and holy bejesus, it is just, I mean, it is garbage, absolutely garbage. Really, one of the things I really noticed, besides just the pure propaganda aspect of it, where they're just like literally saying things that are BS, that are bullshit just to get you to act a certain way. I noticed in one part of it is they were talking about how the COVID measures are different for Broadway now, and that there are people there that on the front page, they have everybody in like a crowd and they're coming through a line, and everybody's got a muzzle on, of course, and then one person is having a straw stuck up their nose, like this is something you're supposed to, like this is okay or something. I mean, it's absolute garbage. If the people in charge of Broadway who are forcing people to take that test of sorts by jamming a swab up your nose, and who knows if they stab you right in the pituitary gland, and then they take out a gun, of course, electromagnetic gun of some sort, and shoot you in the forehead with that thing. I mean, people, you have to understand that these things do something to you. They really do. And they're bad news. Don't trust this stuff. These people are liars. They've been treating everyone like garbage for the last 30 years, increasingly worse. All of us, whether in school, in work, in online, in our general lives, whether we're on one side of the counter or we're the customer, or it's a continual, again, cycle of abuse. And that was clear in the Times there, where they're peddling this and they're trying to normalize it as much as they possibly can. These tactics used by, let's say, the newspapers in this case, and it's the same thing that they do on television, and also having the... This is something that's especially effective, too, is to have little case studies or personal testimonies from people where they, I don't know if these are real people or not. Likely they're not. If they are, then they got bribed, or they're idiots, or they have a vested interest in their position within this hierarchy of abuse that they're trying to hold on to. But they put little personal testimonies about people in there so that you can try to identify with them. Ooh, yeah, oh, okay, that's what people are like. Okay, that's how the general zeitgeist of society is. And I don't want to be a lone outlier here or anything. But that's the trick. That's the trick. They're using that group psychology, that herd mentality that we have to follow large groups of people, and they're using that against us. So recognize that and be willing to see through it. It might not be easy at first. Certainly, most of the time it isn't when you're bucking a large trend. But being able to see when that aspect is being used against you and to propagandize you should be some solid evidence that there's something wrong going on here. And that, again, it comes down to just saying no and not consenting to it. Because ultimately, that's how we get out of this. And other ways that in which we can get out of this. By the way, I should like to say as well, to those who listened to my show last week, Q MAGA's Exorcism, I hope you enjoyed that. It went a little long, just short of an hour and a half. And I'd like to encourage any of those who are listening now to listen to that one, because that's pretty vital. Wherein I go over the pamphlet Exorcism of Tyranny and the way in which it can get us out of this as well. And it's an easy pamphlet to carry around with you that you can pass out to people and leave a written record of where you're coming from that has all the basics that are necessary in order for us to get back to a constitutional role of law and order. So that's vital. So that's the first thing right now, ultimately. That's why I brought it up. That's why I brought it up before I went through it entirely, even though it's the part two of the Great Awakening, as opposed to going through the new economic in its entirety. First, because it's a little bit more important at present. The new economic, or rather a new economic, that I'll be going over. I'm going to go over the pamphlet for that today, because this is an idea that is absolutely revolutionary in its implications and what it can do for really any modern nation state or community, period. That I mean, it's just it took me 15 years to figure it out, and the reason I've been obsessed with this for my adult life, to come up with some sort of answer to the myriad of problems that I saw when I was growing up, and all the horrendous nonsense. Not only nonsense, but also just clearly unnecessary misery and harm that people do to each other in our modern world. Really, just reading the news every day during my adult life is plenty enough to see that there's that great amount of harm there that if I can help to alleviate would certainly justify me being here. And so spending 15 years to figure something out like that, I mean, brainstorming night after night after night after night on this until finally I came up with something. And it really does. I mean, if you look at the mathematical aspects of this, it works. It really does. It does exactly what I say it does. Liberates the people of the world. I'm going to go off the front of the pamphlet here. And again, this is a single page pamphlet, front and back with three leaves. And on the front page it says, The Great Awakening, Part 1, A New Economic, Breaking the Chains That Bind Humanity, or Saving the World in Three Easy Steps. A simple three-step approach to recreate the American Empire, liberate the people of the U.S. and the world, preempt economic collapse, drastically reduce energy consumption, free the human spirit, create the greatest society in written history, and lead the world into the 21st century. So, oddly enough, preempt economic collapse isn't really valid anymore because that already happened to a certain extent. Now it's going to be yet still that economic collapse that is yet to come, so long as we perpetuate and continue the system that we have, will yet be used against us as the manufactured collapses that we've had before in this country, namely that of the Great Depression, also that of what they call the Great Recession, also that of the most recent scamdemic. These are intentional economic downturns that are brought upon by those at the top level in order to gain more power over the population and control. So you can look directly at what happened with the 2008-2009 economic collapse, and I'll go into that one second. Looks like we got some people in here. How you doing, y'all?
Good, how you doing?
Hey, cheers.
Hey,
how do you do? Hello, hello. Well, so concerning 2009, when it came to that collapse, one of the things that we can see about that is that, and naturally, not everyone who was involved in it in one way or the other, because, I mean, everyone's involved in an economy, ultimately. We all have some sort of hand or part to play in it. We're all little, you might call us little gears amongst the greater machine. And we all have some sort of position within it, of course. But you can see those that gain from it and those that end up with the rewards from such a thing when there are so many who end up getting crushed and destroyed. And you can look at them and be like, okay, well, those are the ones who were, planning for this, putting it, orchestrating it in some, at least in some respect, planning for the eventuality and being ready to pounce upon the problem and take advantage of people when they're in their worst straits. And you can see that those who benefit from that very thing, kind of like in the way that you might look at insider trading among, let's say, congressional members, as quite indicative of their implication in the very thing itself. So, in that respect, concerning 2008 and 2009, one of the things that was, one thing that I've heard, and this is the exact stats, I'm not exactly sure of. Don't quite remember. I'd have to pull those things up. But, and for the record, that sort. When it comes to exact stats, I remember these. I remember them in a broad-based sort of manner. The exact numbers. I mean, it's hard to retain those. And that goes back to some of the personal mental theories that I'd given earlier. Anyway. And so during that collapse, you had something like 5 to 10 million people who lost their houses, who were kicked out of their homes, where the bank foreclosed on their house because they couldn't pay their mortgage and the bank took over the house. So let's look at what that really means. Now, if it's a, just a oops, accident, economic collapse type of thing, that goes back to that that plausible deniability that I brought up last week, and that is it's such a common thing that when you have criminals in positions of authority and they can plausibly deny that they had any hand in something, then it can be just like, oh, it's an act of nature, you know, like the crash in 2008 was just a hurricane that showed up or an earthquake, that sort of deal. But really, it doesn't. When you look at the certain aspects of this, you can tell that that's the case. And I would recommend that those who were interested in seeing what was happening at the time and some of the facts behind this, to look into Dylan Radigan's work that he was doing at the time it was happening. He was on MSNBC, I believe, at the time, and he saw through it all through his investigative and journalistic work. So I'd encourage those who are interested in looking into the exact details of why it was that this was engineered of sort to look into that. But considering so, and knowing that it was engineered like it was, one of the major effects that this sort of thing has, that this sort of thing had, was 5 to 10 million people kicked out of their homes. The bank foreclosed on them. And these were people who had mortgages. So these were the folks who, anywhere from a 15-year to a 30-year mortgage, who had paid in for so many years, who ultimately either through hard times of one sort or the other, couldn't pay their mortgage. And they either lost their job or at the time they got sold a mortgage that that for one reason or the other, the people who sold it to them knew that they couldn't pay it, such that they could then repackage those credit default swaps and then sell it off to other banks that eventually is like a hot potato that one bank or the other ends up holding the bag, and they end up getting thrown under the bus for that sort of thing. But in any case, there was a whole lot of people who were legitimately paying their mortgages and on the regular, completely paid up and doing well, that they had a job, and for whatever reason, their job was gone. They couldn't pay the mortgage, and within a month or two, or perhaps a little bit more, whatever, there's different rules for each state. The bank foreclosed on them and took back these houses or apartments that they had. So, the point I'm trying to make here, and this is where it really gets. This is where the injustice really shows up here. Because on the one hand, if you're renting an apartment or you're leasing a house, and the agreement that you have made is that you're going to pay X amount of dollars per month in order to live there. So if you're not paying, if you don't pay that X amount of dollars that month, then you don't get to live there. I mean, that's a basic part of the contract. Now, there's plenty of other laws and bylaws to all of this that we've crafted over the years to address various problems that people might have and to allow them to find some arbitration or to renegotiate their contract or that sort of thing. But ultimately, when you look at rents and leases, that's the case. You're paying a certain amount in order that you can live there. Paying a certain amount to the owner that you can live there. And when you don't pay anymore, then, you don't live there. So in that case, if, let's say you lose your job and you're renting a place, then I'm going to leave, unless you make a deal with the owner or something like that. Now, this changed in the last, after this discussion, I'm going to go into how this is different now concerning the virus panic. But until that point, we'll discuss things as they were at that time and an analysis of that. So that being the case when it comes to rents and leases at that time. And so if it's a... when you have a manufactured economic crisis, that is the intent behind it is to stymie and depress the economy such that people lose their jobs, such that they're not making as much money, such that they can't pay their rent or their lease or their mortgage, such that, I mean, this is the, you might say, the ultimate intention behind these economic downturns, one of them, that is to say. And again, it all comes down to command, control, ownership, power, all that, right? So So that being the intention, you can see what happened in the end of it. So 5-10 million people get kicked out of their houses, and these are particularly mortgagers. So these mortgagers, if they were signed up for, let's say that they were signed up on average, they had 15-year leases, and on average they'd paid 5 years into it, right? So through that contract of the mortgage, now this is something that people need to keep in mind when it comes to these, is that when it comes to mortgage, they say in there, okay, you have to pay this 15 years, and it's going to be X amount of dollars each month until once you pay those 15 years, then you own that building. You own that house, you own that apartment, you own that business, you own that land, et cetera, et cetera. And when that's the case, there is a necessity for there to be stability in the economy in order for someone to pay out that entire 15 years. So if on average you had 5 to 10 million people, let's just say 10 million. 10 million back in 2000, I think it was actually, I'm thinking it was 15 mil. But in any case, an absurd amount, an absurdly high number of people had their houses foreclosed on. If you got 10 million of them, on average, let's say they'd paid in 5 years into a 15-year mortgage. By the end of that, if and when you have an intentional economic depression like this, what you're doing is you're taking that 5 years that they paid into that mortgage, and that you might say that they their one-third stake in that particular property that they've been paying for, namely because 5 is one-third of 15. So 5 years of a 15-year mortgage ought to result in you having a one-third stake in the property that you have mortgaged. So even though you had one-third stake in that property through that mortgage, and you get thrown out, that's a 100% total win for the institution on the other end of that deal. So that's where the injustice comes in, is because when you have these intentional economic downturns brought upon by those in power, and clearly these are lies. I mean, it's absolutely clear to anyone who has their eyes open. For those that don't, I mean, you guys can just, you know, sit on a hill and watch us, you know, while we do this. Just don't get in the way, please. For those who really see this, I mean, it's clear that, and especially this virus panic, I mean, this is just, it's been building up for over 100 years. And you could, back in 1929, people were a little bit more naive, and they didn't necessarily see that that the Great Depression at the time was, I mean, that was engineered. That was brought on. It's intentional. These things don't happen by accidents. There isn't just some, oh, Black Friday, all the stock market went down, and everyone went crazy. No, no. There's a way, way too much connection between those at the top and their control of industries and monetary supply and properties that they're not. The reason they got there is because they were able to find an angle and, you know, in a lot of cases, game the system. Because otherwise they wouldn't be in such a position where they would be this corrupt, if that makes sense. If you had all the people who got rich were all just hardworking folks, and most of the time that's the case. Most of the people who get rich in our country through our system fight against astounding obstacles and forces that go against their wishes and go against their wants and desires and their drive. to get to what they want and to make it happen, make it, you know, make their dreams reality. But that's not all of them. And the systems themselves end up rewarding a fair amount of corruption at the top. And you can see this, the evidence, all the biggest evidence you need is the clear lying that goes on and that is pumped into the soft brains of the population. The astounding amount of propaganda and sheer lies that get told over and over and over and over and over again. And new ones invented every day to see that and to know that our system has been corrupt for a very long time, and that those at the top who are paying the checks for the supposed journalists and the supposed experts and the supposed CEOs and everything else and the supposed politicians and all that sort of thing, they're the ones who are really, I mean, there's some rot and some massive corruption there just by virtue of those lies. So when it comes to that, so you can look at an intentional economic downturn, an engineered economic downturn, just as it relates to mortgages, and you can see the astounding injustice that is done. When you have 10 million people thrown out of their houses, let's say it was an average of 5 years they paid into a 15-year mortgage, what they lose is not just being able to live there. What they lose is not just the money that they had paid in previously. What they have lost is their one-third stake in that property. They have lost, that's what gets taken away from them in that case. And that's what got took away from people in 2008, 2009. And so that is something to keep in mind, that because the takeover here and the outright theft that occurred during that economic downturn was that one-third stake in the property, or one-quarter stake, or half stake, or even in some cases, who knows, some people were probably like, 14 years into a 15-year one, or some that were probably like 28 years into a 30-year one, who'd worked their entire lives, who were near retirement, and were about to own their own property, and own their own house, and their own land, and everything else. And then this gets hit on them. This gets thrown on the people based on lies, chicanery, and corruption. And no one goes to jail for it at all. Remember this, folks. No one went to jail for that 2009 crisis at all. Nobody at all. I mean, the astounding level of corruption is just, it's absolutely endless. It's beyond any sort of most comprehension, and that's one of the reasons that it perpetuates yet still. People have a very hard time even comprehending the level of criminality that has been going on here, and that lack of imagination is biting us in the rear right now. So in that case, what was really stolen was that percentage stake in that property that the people had. And they get thrown out into the street. What do they do? What's left for them? Well, everybody has their own story. But in these cases, and in the case as it concerns the virus panic, the most recent downturn, namely the one intentionally brought upon last March. In this case, were the banks, the big multinational banks and large landholding companies and those who had all the whole bunch of mortgages and that sort of thing, were they to throw people out of their houses en masse, you were going to have millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of people who had nowhere to go and nothing to do, thrown out on the street. And they were clearly, in that case, going to be talking to each other, and they were going to find out who the architects of their plight were, and they were going to go after them. So there was a... When you do that calculation from the level of running a society, when you do that calculation from the level of, say, like from the White House or from large international business or a national business or something like that, you can start to see that, oh yeah, this ain't gonna work out for us. Well, how are we gonna pay off our debts if like in this case, essentially what happened with the virus panic in the real estate market, when it came to mortgages and it came to rent and all that thing, when they forced people to stay home, clearly you had the stats at the time were about 50%, 60% of people didn't even have, they lived paycheck to paycheck. So we've been living paycheck to paycheck for ages, and more so as we've gone on, progressed through the decades since, the 70s. And when you have people who live, that many people who live paycheck to paycheck, when you forcibly stop them from working, they're not going to be able to pay the rent. So what happens? They can't pay it. Lots of times they'll grab whatever they can of savings and then pay everything they can, make a deal with the owner, that sort of thing. But there's so many people that couldn't pay that was going to build in to a level of which, whereas prior in 2009, they could kick all these people out and yet, stagger that over the course of a year, where it's like, okay, well, they kick out 100,000 people in November and then kick out 100,000 people in January and kick out 100,000 people in April or something like that. They could stagger that out such that the enforcement arms of the system and the propaganda apparatuses and the liars at the top could still reasonably lie to enough people, convince them that they screwed up, and divert the attention and focus of all these folks who were completely wronged and ripped off. So they could pull that off back in 2009, but there are way too many when they tried to intentionally force this virus panic on people last March, is that too many people who live in paycheck to paycheck and forcing them all out of their own jobs, except for the, quote, essential workers, and crushing all of these businesses and everything else. If they didn't do the eviction moratorium, there was going to be, 30, 40, 50 million people in the streets. And what were they going to do? Again, they're going to go after the architects of their plight, namely the people responsible for this fake pandemic. So the people who did this knew that. They're quite aware of what would happen were they to do that sort of thing. So they did the eviction moratorium, and then at the same time you had all sorts of bills that obligations, that is to say, that the large landholders necessarily had to pay. Now, a lot of them, the large landholders, can get away with that because they're in thick as thieves with the regulators and the Fed and others. But the small landlords will clearly run into trouble. Now, that's where the first coronavirus relief bill comes in. It wasn't just for unemployment. A lot of it was for backstopping those mortgages and those rents and those leases that people couldn't pay, such that the property management companies could still pay their obligations that they had to others, and they wouldn't fall apart. So basically, it's kind of like it's a... the can got kicked upward through this, and someone ends up holding the bag. ultimately appears it comes down to the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. And since then, they've just been printing out money like there's, you know, like there's no tomorrow, in order to pay all this that people haven't been able to pay in because of this forced economic downturn. Now, so that's the case. That's the case now. Because back then they could pull that off, or they could take those properties, or they could take that percentage of which that the tenant had paid into their percent stake in a particular property, and they just take that. But in this case, they didn't. And instead, they went ahead and just printed out money in order to backstop what all the renters and leasers and mortgagers couldn't pay. At the same time, a lot of people still, I would imagine, still have, although oddly I haven't seen any evidence of this, of people being kicked out of their apartments or their houses or anything else, which is interesting. I haven't heard much news about that either. It seems like that eviction moratorium is roughly still in effect for perhaps a number of different places. So I haven't heard stories about this. And so I think a lot of people are just afraid of losing that, losing the roof over their house, roof over their heads, and what might happen if they don't have the money to pay, that sort of thing. Okay, I'm getting in the weeds here. We were actually, it really went off on a bit of a tangent here. But nonetheless, this is something to keep in mind when it comes to these economic downturns, because you can see who benefits, and then you can have a better idea of who engineered it. That is to say, the architects of the plight. So, considering mortgages as well, I should also say what it is that the theory that I'm that particularly pertains to the functioning of the new economic is that of mortgages and loans taken out in through banks. So when you look at mortgages, this is the creation of money, really. Ultimately, it's like, okay, when we go out in a job, what we're doing is we're trading our labor for money, that unit of exchange. So it's kind of like we're going out and getting money as opposed to making money. But making money is what a bank does. And this is how they actually make the money. It's not like, you know, a bank just asks the Treasury Department and they throw it, you know, thousands of dollars, and then all of a sudden they have it there. And it's not like modern monetary theory. And that's what's happening now. They're using that as a justification for the economic ridiculousness that's happening at present. But ultimately, the way that money is created, in the sense of the old sense, back in the 1800s, back in, you know, 1600s, 1500s, all that, even now, is basically through faith in credit. So the fractional reserve banking allows for a bank to only have a small percentage of the amount of money that they're beholden to, the amount of money they're supposed to have on hand. They only need to have a small percentage of that in actual cash, in capital, on their premises, having access to it. The rest of it they can loan out. So they can make new loans based on what they have coming in. So so if you got a bank that that has a mortgage coming from somebody. They own five properties. They own five properties, and two of them are on mortgages. These were signed by the tenants there, and they said that, okay, well, we'll pay you $1,000 a month for 15 years, and we'll own the property. That's their contract, right? So, and there's two people who have it. So it's $1,000 each. So it's $2,000 in a month that the bank knows that they're getting in. And by the end of that 15 years, they know they're going to get $150,000 per, so they're going to get $300,000 total out of all that. So by the end of it, when you look at that, okay, well, that's $300,000 in those mortgages, in those contracts, that they, if these people are trustworthy and you have faith in them and you know that the bank knows that they're going to be able to pay each month, and the bank knows that by the end of that 15 years, they'll have $300,000 that came from them. So with that $300,000, considering the position that they are now, they could potentially loan that back out. So even though they're only getting $2,000 per month from these actual tenants who have this mortgage, they can nonetheless still reasonably, to a certain amount of, percentage of likelihood, be able to loan out up to $300,000 based on these two mortgages. Because the people who signed their name on that contract are the ones who are underwriting the money that is thereby then put out for other loans. So the bank knows that they're getting that $2,000 each month. By the end of that 15 years, they're going to have $300,000 total. And in the meanwhile, they can loan out to a certain amount of risk. Now, this is where the risk comes into the calculation. Okay, how trustworthy is this person? How much do you expect that they're going to be able to get back to you to pay each month? But really, that's it. So it's the person who signs that contract. It's their name and the likelihood that they're going to be able to pay it back that ultimately makes, quote-unquote, makes money in the banking system. So that's what underwrites pretty much everything. Now, generally, let's say you want to start a bank, you'd have to go with some sort of capital investment in order to get some properties or be able to loan out money such that you can start getting interest on it. But that's a startup cost, and once you get the ball rolling here, and you have a bunch of clients who you can depend on, then you know that you're going to be having something coming in on the regular that you can use to backstop your further loans. So that being the case, ultimately, all of those loans and all that money ultimately all comes down to someone signing their name and saying, yes, I'm going to pay you X amount of dollars over the course of Y number of years. And that's how much. That's how much that bank's going to get. You add that risk assessment percentage on there, likelihood, that sort of thing. And then, boom, that's how much money you got to play with, basically. And so, considering that, the rest of the new economic here works as such. And I'm going to lay these out pretty quick. I think I might have run through this before. I don't think it was one of the episodes that we recorded, but anyway. And also, by the way, I go over this on a YouTube video as well. Feel free to go to my YouTube channel, check it out at Garrett Tufte, and you can see me talk about this on a more large scale level. And that was just before the virus panic kicked in. So I released that in February of 2020. Anyway, so a new economic, saving the world in three easy steps. Here's step one. Step one, properties. Anyone who legally occupies a residence may opt to own it. Repeat for other properties utilized by the person or family, cars, agricultural land, farming equipment, and the building in which a business is located, etc. Appropriate housing is given to the homeless. A note on process, it may be most efficient to process leases and deeds at the local level and put the appraised monetary value into a new account at the time of ownership transfer and application. We'll get to that later. Because there are two steps here that that need to be that they don't work unless they're done together. And then the second step, accounts, is optional. So step one, properties. Anyone who legally occupies a residence may opt to own it. Repeat for other properties utilized by the person or family, cars, agricultural land, farming equipment, building in which a business is located, etc. Appropriate housing given to the homeless. Step two, accounts. Debts, foreign and domestic, are forgiven, and subject accounts in USD, e.g., are used to pay foreign debts. That's a step that's optional. But step three, reconciliation. In a new tangible currency, former owners are paid the appraised value of each property transferred in step one. So, a note on processes. Those are the three steps. That's it in their entirety. Now, the real getting into the weeds and the actual details of each one of these and in the process of actually affecting it, there's going to be 1,000 different changes to this. This is the sort of thing like when I brought up prior that this sort of thing is kind of like talking about the moon landing. And so looking at this as something like the moon landing, or rather the Apollo program, that's the sort where you look at what's been done in space and how much effort was made in order to put this together and to make that happen, to send up a rocket, land men on the moon, and then bring them back safely. So theoretically, at the time, I mean, who knows, where did the original idea come from? I mean, you can look way back to Jules Verne and H.G. Wells on that front. They end up coming up with the idea that it's like, okay, well, it can be done. Okay, well, someone comes along and says, theoretically, can it really be done? What are the metrics? What are the sorts of things that you would need in order to make this happen? In a similar manner, you might look at this plan as that. Here's the proof that such a thing can be done. Now, putting it into effect on the level of the United States is not going to be simple. And you don't do it overnight. You need an army of accountants. You need to bring up the idea, introduce it to the population. And, I mean, it's clearly not a simple, just an undertaking that can happen overnight. And if it is, then that could end up bad. That could end up badly. Because there's a lot of infrastructure-related issues that would need to be altered before putting this thing in. Now, I think in some ways that the virus panic that is going on has, oddly enough, been something that has changed our economy and our infrastructure to such a level that we could actually reasonably do this with less problems than we could have 2 years ago when I first brought it up. Namely, because the population generally, not just in the United States, but elsewhere across the world, is starting to understand that the excessive international global trade that we have had is not the sort of thing that's sustainable. So when they talk about, this is a bit of a tangent here. When people talk about, especially those the top people like the World Economic Forum and let's say the New York Times, I mean, they're talking about climate issues there too. When they're talking about how, we want a sustainable future. We need a sustainable future. It needs to be sustainable such that, we're not using up resources faster than they can be regrown. Now, that's vital. It's true. Makes sense. Of course. You know? And just mathematically, that's the case. When you look at, particularly, you look at the example of oil and you look at it and be like, okay, well, this stuff doesn't, grow on trees. I mean, literally, I mean, you could look at money and be like, yeah, money actually grows on trees. But because apples grow on trees and you can sell apples for money. But oil is something else, since it takes a very long time in order for it to develop in the earth before we can utilize it for our own purposes. And you could look at something like ethanol coming from corn, and there might be ways that we could utilize that in order to actually have a sustainable fuel for our vehicles and for industry that actually regrows every year. Now, the energy return on investment isn't the best, and when you start to see that, I mean, particularly, even though we've heard things about peak oil before, that said oil's going to peak out and it's going to start, getting to such a level where it's extremely expensive and we're not going to be able to use it as such a common transportation fuel, that sort of thing. A lot of those predictions are clearly not true, because they were talking about that happening back in 2004, as it is. But that being the case, and maybe the predictions that they have now that, we're going to get to some level of oil usage that is not sustainable, or we're going to get to some level of usage on that front that's going to drop off a cliff in 2030 or 2040 or something like that. In any case, eventually that point's going to come along. And you can see that point's coming on quicker than usual, because you look at the oil extraction techniques that they have today, namely the tar sands up in Alberta, and the not only the horrendous environmental disaster that is, but also the fact that the energy return on investment of such a thing is something like 2 to 1. So you're expending half the energy that you get from something in order to get it. So that's really just tremendously inefficient. And you look at something like the early Pennsylvania oil fields, and you look at those in Texas. This would be at the beginning of the 20th century, late 19th century. And then you see that the energy return on investment is something like 60 to 1, 40 to 1. And you can see something similar in other oil fields that we have today. But when you start to see energy being extracted with that level of inefficiency, then you know that there's something wrong with our energy system. You know that there's something wrong with our supply of these quite vital resources. So getting to a sustainable world is super important. And that is true. But the people at the top who are talking about that, they're using that in order to gain further control of the people of the world. Unfortunately, they are. It seems like everything that can that can possibly be used to abuse and control people is being used and abused to control people. It's kind of like Murphy's Law on a societal level. It's unfortunate. But knowing that that's the case is one of the is vital for, you know, just about anybody to operate in some manner where you retain your self-respect and you still live a happy and fruitful life. And so that sustainability is vital. And considering that point, the line that I like to use is globalist polluting with globalism claim globalism the solution to pollution. hopefully that shows just how ridiculous that sort of thing is. When you can look at the hypocrisy of someone hopping on their private jet in order to go to Switzerland for a climate conference, but even more so, you can see worse so the astounding amounts of plastic garbage that's sent over from China across the Pacific Ocean just over to us, when you could make the same thing in a factory, you know, one town over with no problem here in the States. You know, it's just it's completely inefficient, and it doesn't make any sense at all from a sustainability perspective and from an America First perspective and from a economic perspective, I mean a sane economic perspective. but nonetheless, that sort of thing has come about. So watch out for that. Nonetheless, that's what this system here allows for this new economic in its effect of bringing the economy down to a manageable and reasonable level. That creates that sustainability. So if what we do is the whole world as here's the thought experiment. So if China is the big manufacturing powerhouse right now, we send all our factories over there. You know, we still have some here, but not a whole lot. Vast majority of people end up in the service industry here in the States, or in some bloated quasi-governmental industry like education or healthcare or other things of that matter. Mainly those two, but with China as the, you know, one big manufacturing hub, and all the Chinese, 1.5 billion people, all shoved into these factories in order for them to make any number of things. For slave wages, of course, and while they're tyrannized in every way possible by an oppressive government, which really doing business with them is morally quite sketchy. But nonetheless, if you look at the efficiency of having one hub for manufacturing things that gets sent all over the world, such that you can't get a screw of a certain size unless it's shipped across the ocean. Like, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's complete nonsense. And what it does is, in its centralization, it takes away our individual ability on the local level, not just individual, but our ability on a community level and on a state level, to create these things for ourselves. And we open ourselves up to economic abuse of sorts. Like, I would imagine, is something similar that happened with the virus panic. All you'd have to do if you were Xi Jinping in order to enforce any number, or that is to say, export any number of oppressive Chinese governmental practices to the rest of the world, is to say, hey, you're going to treat your people like garbage, and you're going to lie to them about this virus, or we are going to stop all exports to you. And with that sort of leverage, you can pull off a whole lot, clearly. And I think that was something that was used against us back then. So the centralization of manufacturing processes into a place like China or elsewise is not sustainable at all. It's not efficient. It's a waste of energy. It allows for your country to get hosed, your entire population, to have basically you got a gun to your head when it comes to, oh, okay, well, you're not going to get that concrete that you use in order to build all your houses, or hey, you know, those screws that are vital, or these particular replacement parts, or in the case of Taiwan, they're talking about semiconductor chips. Any number of these things, when they're centrally manufactured, can be used against a trading partner in order to enforce any number of other concessions on their part. So that's something to keep in mind as well. And so don't fall for it when the globalists tell you that, we're going to have this sustainable green world and all that sort of thing, and we're all going to be living in happy harmony, you know, from the UN, of all places, United Nations, the most top-heavy and an absurd, ridiculous level of imposition of policy on our lives that is so far divorced from what we actually do, that it's meaningless in many ways. And again, that applies to international corporations, large management holding companies. If the apartment that you're in, the apartment complex that you're in, is managed by a company that's owned in Switzerland, like, how does that help you? How does that make any sense? How can they manage it from the other side of the world? Like, they can't at all. And it's not sustainable, and it's not efficient, and it's not helpful, and it's a bizarre abuse of reality for for that to be enforced upon the world. So this plan, amongst many other things, is a way in order to bring some economic justice for everybody out there, whether you're rich, poor, somewhere in between, to bring our economic system into some level of sustainability that can be perpetuated without getting screwed over by actors with abusive economic practices, namely like China, and also to scale things in to a level of locality that makes sense to us on an individual level, a community level. It makes sense to for us to actually see what it is what we're really doing, to have the real rewards stay where we are. And when it comes to the inevitable inflation and the endless national debt, on a national level, brought up on a national level, not only clears out the national debt, because it's done for on this, but it also allows us to basically, you know, remake the most corrupt parts of our governance and business practices that have been going on and getting worse for decades. It allows us to remake, get rid of all the garbage, get rid of all the corruption that'd been in there, and keep all the good things that we have at the same time. So when you talk about revolutions, and people talk about revolutions, lots of times they think, okay, Bolshevik Revolution, the communists went in there, they took out the royalty, and they took control of the means of production, and they kicked out the business owners and all that sort of thing. Like, that's not just. And similar to the French Revolution, also, a lot that was happening there, not just at all. But the American Revolution, in my opinion, was entirely. But maintaining justice in that revolution is, I think, vital for this, and that's what this does, because in the reconciliation process, everyone who had a prior business, prior property, building, house that was being rented or leased or mortgaged to someone else, they get the equivalent in the new currency. And so they end up being the richest, either individuals or companies or what have you, in this new economy. And at the same time, the people who legally occupy a residence, they get that house. They own it, but they don't have money. They get to own it, but they don't have money. So they have to go out and work. So they have to go out and work for the people who have it. And so everyone's benefited here. And it's also 100% constitutional as well. And that's because there is recompense given to those whose property is, you know, quote, taken away. And the exact amount of recompense, running through all the numbers on this, again, it's going to take an army of accountants. And I don't expect it's going to be done tomorrow or anything. But there's an arbitration process for that very thing. That even if it takes a while, that's why it's systematic. That, you know, just one step at a time. You know, this particular landlord doesn't think he's getting enough for his 4-unit apartment complex that all just went to the tenants. Okay, well, how much does he say that it's worth? All right, well, let's look at the complex itself. All right, based on the quality and the maintenance that's necessary for it. It was made in this year, and the plumbing and the electricity and all that sort of thing, it's worth about X amount of dollars, so I think it's worth this much. Then you have his lawyer come over, and then they say that it's worth that much, and you know, you'll back and forth on these sorts of things. It's called arbitration, and we're really good at that in this country. I mean, we can do just, if we stick with constitutional law and the common law that we've been running with for a long while, reassert the constitutional law and maintain the common law that we have going right now, we can do anything. We really can, my friends. And we can make this, tomorrow a better and more just society than today. Okay. Let's finish the flyer here. So those are the three steps. Step one, property. Step two, accounts. Step three, reconciliation. A note on process, and maybe most efficient process, deeds, leases and deeds at a local level. Put the appraised monetary value into a new account at the time of ownership transfer. Application. These propositions may be undertaken by any nation state or group that would benefit from such an economic revolution. Wants to clean up its finances as a declaration of monetary independence, while maintaining property value and relative economic position of its citizens. And the middle leaf, step two, accounts. Note, this step is optional. I have my name there, email, website, June 18th, 2021. That's when this version is from. Step three, reconciliation. That's the third leaf. And below it says qualifications. If a person or family owns their own home outright and resides there, they receive full appraised value in the new currency. This is a continuation of the concept that each property is paid in such a manner that we maintain property value and still have plenty of currency in circulation in order to facilitate a vibrant economy. So, if a person or family owns their own home outright and resides there, receive full appraised value in the new currency. Yes, and this is to ensure justice for those who have spent so much of their life and worked very hard to get where they were, such that they get that extra reward on top of it. And it works. Mortgagers receive the value of which they had previously paid. Yes. So their percentage stake in the property gets paid out to the mortgager, and the bank receives the remainder. So the bank's percentage stake in that property, the bank gets the payout for that. Pensions are transformed similarly. So when you've got a retirement account, you can transfer these as well. It's kind of complex to explain that. I would recommend going to my website and checking out the diagrams, particularly related to loan and pension diagrams. There's a couple of them in there. Implementation. These propositions need not necessarily be affected as though in sudden acts. Yes, it can be done through not necessarily a step-by-step, but, you know, one portion at a time, and even like a parallel economy type of thing, that just like, okay, in regard to that of this particular industry where it relates to, I mean, you can affect it in such a manner as well. And then on the back page, there's two final leaves here. The first leaf says, everyone in America becomes a debt-free homeowner at minimum. What will this do for crime, for stress levels, for overwork, for overconsumption? What will this do for any and every problem currently ravaging this country and the world? This plan makes the American dream happen for everyone all at once. When we reopen the market, prices will swing before stabilizing, but nothing terrible can happen. Everyone will be in a near-perfect economic position. This is a revolution, not a revolt. The people in power benefit too. They will come out as the richest in the country to preside over a free, strong, independent, and grateful population. Are you ready for a new paradigm? Be a self-interested jerk for a moment. Forget the abstract classes, forget the government, forget the corporations, forget the political isms, and simply ask yourself, would this benefit me? This plan asks only that you and us all be selfish. Everyone wins, regardless of class, race, religion, or gender. Have you ever wanted to follow your passion, but worried that you would lose your job, your apartment, or your house? The goal of this plan is for you to own your apartment, to own your house, to own your car, to own your business, and to be free of any and all kinds of debt. And to help them make this happen, simply spread the word, and it will. So that is A New Economic, Great Awakening, Part 1, an economic revolution that has never been done so far as the history books claim in history. And it really would do everything that it says. And it can be affected on pretty much any level of organization. So at the city level, at the county level, local, at the state level, at a national level. I would not recommend it necessarily for a global level. That seems, as I suggested before, a bit unsustainable, quite top-heavy, and far divorced from our actual lives as human beings, that I believe an economic system needs to at least have some connection to. So with that, I believe I'll leave you to it. I've gone a little bit over time here. All the same, I think it's important that I go over that Great Awakening Part 1. That's the flyer, New Economic. There's also a large chart for this as well that explains particularly the large-scale effects that such a thing would have and the benefit that would come from that when it comes to some big geopolitical changes. And so again, also, if you want to see some more on that, check out my YouTube channel, Garrett Tufte. You can find it there. And yes, I would encourage you all to check this out, look into it. And one of the things about this too is that if you look into why and how this works, you will learn some things about our economic system and the banking system that you never would have imagined, and you will be quite surprised, quite informed, and highly enlightened when you do. So, toward that end, and toward every end, that is a blessing, and is good for us. I hope you all stand up for yourselves, stick your chest out, keep your heads up high, walk out into that world, do the things that you want to do, and wow, that was a excuse me. Loud crash and banging there. It is October 20th, 2021. My name is GT Maverick, and I'm wishing you peace, love, harmony, justice, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.